patrol. Since Joe and I were now not speaking to each other, Tim could now tell the band that Joe and I were fighting. All this happened in the middle of a year-long world tour for the album Get a Grip. Talk about living on the edge. WTF. But that's how it was, and obviously not just in this band. How about Keith and Mick, Dave and Ray Davies, Jimmy Page and Robert Plant, and John and Paul? How is it that the best of us can be so manipulated? Fuck, we did turn out like our heroes, but not in the way we thought. Joe and Tim were to Aerosmith what the world perceived John and Yoko to be to the Beatles, without a doubt. What were the band members, the wives, and the managers, all in bed together? Talk about fucked. That's the heroine of it all. To find out that we'd spent years turning reality into a dream and watching it turn into a nightmare. That's death by heroin. I spent 3 weeks at Sierra Tucson, a multi-purpose attitude reconditioning facility or whatever. First day I'm there, the therapist asks me, So, Steven, we start with some questions. Ever had an outside affair? Well, yes. Okay, send him to sexual therapy. Next, have you ever had a member of your family die when you weren't there? Well, you see, my grandmother, grief counseling. Have you ever had problems at home with your wife and children? Well, see, I'm often on the road for months at a time and don't see family orientation group. After I left there, I had 6 or 7 isms hung around my neck. Drug addict, alcoholic, sex addict, codependent, family concerns, anger management, rhino clit, dwarf cock, whale watcher, beekeeper. Oh, and did I mention compulsive narcissism? Oh, yeah. I had a full range of life issues. The bad news? How did they know? The good news? The last week of any stint in rehab, you have what's called family week. And as I have 2 families, my biological family and that other one, the band, guess who came to dinner? Of course, there's all these therapists with their fucking theories. John and Yoko went to Arthur Janoff for scream therapy. Let's see, if people scream when they're really scared, what if... No, wait. What if we get them to scream indoors when they're not scared? That way, maybe they won't scream when they do get scared, and we'll have invented a new emotion. Yes, that's it. Hungry, angry, lonely, and Janoff. It took me a good 3 weeks to get any love from the counselors who were constantly trying to label me and figure me out. To make me recognize shame, feel bad about my bad self. They said leave Steven Tyler outside and bring Steven Tallarico inside. And never the twain shall meet? As fucking if. They tried to make me wear my clothes in disarray, as they said, inside out and put a patch on me that said, no talking to females. All that did was attract the freaks. He was a bold man who ate the first oyster, and they were about to get to know him real well. Meanwhile, I'm still waiting for that counselor to tell it like it is. So, on family day, we, the band plus management, go around the room, and then they get to Bob Dowd, who was hired by management primarily as a drug cop to keep the band sober. Imagine that. This guy was a real Nevada trooper who knew little about human interaction and nothing about Rockstar's evil ways. And Tim goes and makes him Aerosmith's fucking tour manager? Bob would sit with us, keeping an eye on us while Joe and I were trying to write songs. I'd say, you know, Bob, we don't write so good with people watching us. You're blowing the vibe. Of course, that would be translated into, Steven's causing trouble. He wants me out. He must want to do drugs. So at the session, I laid into him. I don't appreciate you following us around like a cop. Stay out of it. Besides, I mumbled to myself, your arm's too short to box with God, and you don't know anything about addiction. Tim, in Bob's defense, looked at the counselors and said, I hired him to make sure no one was using. Leave him alone. And by the way, that's the way it's gonna be. The counselors looked at Tim in astonishment and said, you may be the sickest one here. The tension was beyond belief. That's when I screamed, Hallelujah! I took some boxes and pushed them together in the middle of the floor of this room of mucho agitacion. I grabbed my giant scarf from the corner of the room and threw it over the boxes and said, from here on out, I dub thee the Shroud of Touring, and we shall take it with us as a good luck sign to never forget this moment. And with that, I grabbed my coffee cup, poured it into a goblet, and made a toast to the band. Here's to hell. May we have as much fun there as we had getting there. The manipulation never stopped with personal management, money management, and the addiction counselors. One day, after the Tucson incident, and Neck Deep and the Get a Grip album, they all came to my house. And wouldn't you know, these cretins all came from the Malibu home for the recently all right. Apparently, they had concerns about the way the album process was going. They said, look, we feel you're really not writing the way you did before, so we think, you know, it would really be all right to get a blowjob once in a while. These were words of wisdom coming from the Total Aerosmith management package. And I said, wow, that's great, you guys. So does that mean you'll bring me a beer once in a while, too? And which one of you guys are going to blow me right now? Don't you know one drink is much too many and a million's not enough? Let's see, do I want to be a dancing bear here? Do I want to give up that easy? Do I really want to keep the right ones out and the wrong ones in? Or do I want the world to think that I'm mysterious and dark and that I get my lyrics from the devil's den? Let me think. In 1992, we were recording Get a Grip with a band. I was working on Fever with Joe when I hit on one of the best lyrics I think I've ever written. I was so proud of it and thought it was so funny that I brought it to the band with such a frog-eating grin that Tom said, what's the matter? What do you got? And so I said, check that shit out. The buzz that you be getting from the crack don't last. I'd rather be ODing on the crack of your ass. Yeah, we're all here, 'cause we're not all there tonight. Silence. Crickets. A blank look, and then Tom turns to me and says, are you gonna sing that lyric on the song? Excuse me? I knew where he was going with that, because he's hit me with that same type of sideways getting into something shit before. Steven, I was just, wondering. What, man, what? Knowing the other shoe was gonna drop. Well, just fucking say it, will ya? And Tom says, that's not going on my album. That's one of my favorite lines of all time, Tom. And by the fucking way, what do you mean that's not going on my album? I wrote the fucking song, not you. If it wasn't for this internal mental fucking backwash, I wouldn't have the inspiration to write the next song, I said. If I could have bottled the anger I felt in that moment, I would have quit the band and bought Madrid and hung out with the lemurs for the rest of my life. Oh, well, and speaking of anger, when you get into bed with A&R men, that all-time adage is so true. Can't live with them, can't live without them. Or maybe it's, if you lie down with dogs, nah. But do they really do a band good? Did the infamous A&R diva, John Colodner, really help us out? He insisted that every time his name was put on the back of an album, it be written twice. I guess he subscribed to my point of view that anything worth doing is worth overdoing. Actually, it was a good luck thing in the end, and so I think the best thing John Colodner ever did was to challenge us, to bring us around as real songwriters. The truth to the secret success of our marriage was that we let him in to begin with, saying, fuck it, just try it. That was my credo. Okay, maybe some Tibetan monk living in a cave with yak butter in his hair said it first. Kolodner's input as far as what a song should be and where songs should go was antiquated, but all the same very effective. But his instincts were godlike. What he did do, however, was say in his nasal whine, Steven, that's great. Don't bore us. Get to the chorus. And it'll be a hit single if you put strings on it. Kind of like if a tree falls in the woods and there's no one there to hear it, does it still make a sound? And would that hit be a single? Or if a man has an opinion and a woman's not there to hear it, is he still wrong? Yeah, I like that better. Sometimes Colodner would hear different choruses after songs were already written. Once, when we were out of songs for permanent vacation, I grabbed the guitar and started playing the riff to St. John, which at the time was a shell just waiting to be filled in. That's fucking great, Colodner says. Your instincts are right. You always write the best songs under last-minute pressure. Of course, I hated hearing him say that, but it was true. I was in Vancouver in a hotel room by myself, gnawing the furniture, trying to come up with songs for Get a Grip. John Colodner didn't like the lyrics to Crying, and for a month, the walls of my room were covered with scotch tape and scraps of paper. Covered. I rewrote the lyrics to that song till I tore a hole in my brain 3-4 times, and after the month I went, fuck it, I'm singing the original lyrics. There was a time when I was so broken-hearted. Love wasn't much of a friend of mine. The tables have turned, yeah, 'cause me and them ways have parted. That kind of love was the killing kind. Now listen, all I want is someone I can't resist. I know all I need to know by the way that I got kissed. That's the first verse, and it sets up a beautiful story. And it sang so good. That's what Kalodner was leaving out of his equation, singing. He was hearing it literally, and I was singing between the notes. He didn't understand that it doesn't matter what the fuck I sing if it ain't got that thing. I would be scatting, which sticks to your soul. But he was looking for meaning and understanding, which he ain't gonna find in that verse, because I didn't write it that way. It just sings so good with the melody I wrote that it's irrefutable. When he called me unreasonable, I always rubbed it in his face. What was written on the subway walls? John, there's a very famous saying by George Bernard Shaw that goes something like this. Reasonable people adapt themselves to the situations they find themselves in. But the unreasonable man insists on trying to make the world see things his way. Therefore, it's the unreasonable sons of bitches who are always the catalysts for progress. You can ruin anything by over-intellectualizing it. I want my lyrics coming straight at you. I don't want everything explained, rationalized, sanitized, and homogenized. I'm writing, deuces are wild, and Kalodner the fucking Mameluke says, what are deuces? No one plays cards anymore. He was right. Back then, before TV poker became all the rage in the 2000s. But deuces, when I'm done with them, are sonic dice. I'll make those bones dance. I love you 'cause your deuces are wild, girl. Yeah, double shot at love is so fine. I've been loving you since you was a child, girl. 'Cause you and me is two of a kind. It had nothing to do with deuces. It had everything to do with gambling as a metaphor for love, betting everything on the hand you're dealt. Love, gambling, romance, games of chance. And by the way, Deuces Are Wild is on the side of the fastest funny car in the world. Do they look at it and go, huh? What does that mean? They know what it means. Deuces are wild. The car's fucking fast. So what? If a girl came out naked and she had E equals MC squared on her tits, do you think no one would lust after her because they didn't understand it? Salieri, in the film Amadeus, that fucking prick. You know who he really was? Mozart's A&R man. Salieri the sycophant, who agrees with Emperor Joseph II, who agrees with the music director that there are just too many notes in Mozart's opera. A&R men, that's the way they talk. Start with this, put that in there. The critics, too, can drive me crazy. Their style of dissecting things rubs me the wrong way. Style is just the invention of critics who need classification. And all classification stinks of death, as a poet once wrote. However, remaining open to criticism can take you to places you may never have gone to on your own. Thank you, John Kalodner. John Kalodner, you're a genius and I love you. No one can wear a dress better than you, including me. Dude looks like the bearded lady. Can you sing? Can you dance? Tim Collins couldn't clap twos and fours to a click track to save his life, but he saved ours. Wait, I know what they'll say. Salieri was integral. If it hadn't been for Salieri making Mozart mad, he wouldn't have written his Requiem. And they would have a point. Whenever somebody said, you can't do that, it just made me want to sing it even louder. Because that's what the 60s were all about. Hatred of rules, regulations, the accepted way of doing things. Now, it's all fucked. Now, it's nothing but mock rebellions. It's all, why, I'll show you. I'll do a reality show and shit on the table. Yeah, that's it. Give me the freaks, the geniuses, the confused, the Daltons, the great unwashed, and the ones in doubt. All great art will tip the card. And I'm not, by the way, claiming Aerosmith is the fucking Sistine Chapel. Why, no. No great art was ever created by playing it safe. Now, in the new Gigabyte iPod apps 2.0 US of A's, they're all cloned, certified, and convincified. There are automatons out there. It's like a universal horror movie, except instead of giant ants oozing nuclear snot, it's the professionals, lawyers, doctors, shrinks, and A&R men, with a learned conditioned responses, their stock answers to every fucking thing. A little unknown secret? Listen to the things they're not saying, and you'll find out what they really are saying. Well, you see, if I were in your situation, given the parameters of the... Professionally speaking, if you were to ask my canned opinion, shut the front door. Lawyers were brought into the folds of the band to advise us how to handle ourselves in the case of stalkers and how to talk to female employees. For example, if we ever get stalked by a twisted fan, what not to do? Never talk to the person. And since no one in the band ever does talk to fans, what's the problem? Just don't talk to that person if you sense they're stalking you. That was their blanket statement. Thank you, and bye. How much was that, Mr. Manager, sir? Oh, well, that was only 15 grand to bring in the lawyers again. The band looks at me and says, it's all your fault. You talk to everyone. And then Joe and Billy started having stalkers, and then came the beginning of the end. Here's a case in point. I'm vacationing at my summer home with all my kids for the first time. I'm cooking breakfast, and I see someone jump over my fence. My ex-wife, Teresa, says, I'll take care of this, and starts walking toward the door. And I say, no, you don't. I got this one. So this guy is standing at my back door pushing the doorbell. I said, what's going on here? What are you doing jumping over my fence? This is the last place I can go to get away from people like you. You could get shot jumping over my fence like that. What are you doing here? Well, my mother said you wrote a song about me. Looking in his eyes, I could tell he was on something or off his meds. I was standing close enough to see his hand so I'd be able to stop him if he went to grab for something. I said, I write a lot of songs about a lot of people. How do you know this one's to you? Well, you sang Tommy, Now It's Untrue. And I went blank. Tommy? No, it's actually Tell Me. But it could be Tommy. Yeah, if you want it to be Tommy, it could be Tommy. I didn't correct him. I asked him, where's your mom? Well, she died when I was 3. She left a note to me in a letter. So that was his connection with the mother. I'm not going to take that away from him. So I said, as far as I'm concerned, it's Tommy. From here on out, I'm going to sing it like that. Now get out of here, with a wink, and don't ever climb over the fence again. I could have called the cops, but I diffused it myself. Half the people in the world who hear your music own it anyway. And it's exactly what you want them to do. Marco Hudson told me a story about when he was hanging out with John Lennon and the Hollywood Vampires during the Walls and Bridges May Pang Kotex on the Head moment in 1973. You gotta see this picture. Marco buzzing around Lennon's hive. Methinks a bit too much. Lennon let Marco ask him one question about the Beatles. So he asks John about the lyric from Happiness is a Warm Gun. The image of the velvet hand and the lizard, it meant so much to me, said Marco. Can you tell me where it came from and what it means? Lennon, Marco's greatest hero in life, replies, doesn't mean nothing. Sounds good coming off me tongue. I just write the words. You make up the meaning. My best friend was both crushed and liberated, but it points back to interpretation. People ask all these questions about Dream On. What does it mean? What do you mean, what does it mean? It means dream on. You figure it out. You're the one listening to it. Make up your own meaning. While I was working on 9 Lives, I was clean and sober. I was high on life. But Tim Collins was convinced I was using. How could I be that jacked and on the natch? I think Tim wanted to catch me doing drugs in the worst way. I went to Tim Collins' office. I could tell by the smell of sulfur in the room that he was working on something diabolical, the monster. Dark deeds were afoot. Stephen, we're going to send you to a retreat in Big Sur for a week. We think it'll do you good. Whenever I hear that something's for my own good, bang, alarms go off in my brain. I'm going to go to a retreat in Big Sur with who? A men's group from New York, all professional guys, captains of industry. You'll get on with them famously. Bob Timmons, Tim's Weasley minion, chimed in. Oh, that sounds like fun, I said. It'll be 5 minutes of silence, and the rest of the week it's going to be, dude, man, what was it like singing Dream On, man? Or, I got to tell you something, man, I got laid to your fucking records last week. You know what that would be like for me at 60 with another bunch of 60 fucking year olds? Do you know that my wife and I made love to your song and we got 7 good children out of it? That marked the beginning of my communication breakdown with Tim Collins. In my head, I was going, na 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 na. Ha! I was covering my ears so I couldn't hear this crap. There was no way in hell I was going. Taj was 4 and Chelsea was 8, and it was hard enough being away from them for so long. But to come back from making a record and go to a fucking men's club in Big Sur with a bunch of, you know, sober testosterones? Bad enough going to a fucking bar and talking to those guys. Sober, it's 10 times worse. They're going to remember every epiphanous moment they had in their teenage years when they were watching porn, getting stoned, and listening to Sweet Emotion while fingering the girl next door. I'm not going, you fucks, I said. I just got back from finishing a fucking record, and it turned out great, by the way. Thanks for asking. They'll tell you they were only suggesting I go, but it's like the Pope suggesting to the Boston Cardinal that he better change the subject matter of his sermons, or he's going to go away for a year to a retreat in the Azores. Because when I objected, Bob Timmons said, no, you have to go. We've already booked it. And the sleazy duo started trying to talk me into it. I got really angry. I haven't seen my wife in over 2 months. What are you guys thinking of? Enough of your fucking control issues. Wait a fucking minute. It wasn't all that long ago, back when I was in Tucson, Arizona, that you were telling me I could get a blowjob, and now you're telling me that I should go away? For what? I said, fuck you, I'm not going there. I walked out and slammed the door. Now keep in mind, this is a guy that helped massage and facilitate our sobriety. He was a strong advocate for us, but all along, he was taking sleeping pills, anxiety medication. Necessary, apparently, because he's managing Aerosmith. And binge eating. He's up in his hotel room eating cheeseburgers. There's 3 main entrees on the room service trolley. That's a drug, too. Still, I intended never to return. The era was over. He knew it. So he gathered the band to Boston in the basement situation room for an emergency meeting and told them, Steven's out of his mind. We gotta get his wife on the phone. He went upstairs and proceeded to call my wife. Pure vindictive crap. Joe was shocked that he'd actually done it. He said, you did what? What the fuck? Actually, I was almost a year sexually sober, so if they told me to go fuck myself, I couldn't have even done that. All this while Sly Stallone was trying to hook me up with the most lascivious, sweetly sweaty Floridian pulchritude known to man. I would go to clubs 3 times a week with him. Girls all over the place. Boobs and thongs, just like in Girls Gone Wild, everywhere. The most I would do is say goodnight to them. Oh, you're leaving us, baby. Well, ladies, you can walk me back to the hotel if you like. Okay. And 3 or 4 of them would walk me to the corner across the street from the main entrance of the Marlin Hotel. I would say, okay, girls, you have to stay here. I'm going in there alone so I can get back to writing lyrics to stories yet untold. A saint, I tell you. After leaving Tim's office, I stomped out the door and drove to Sunapee to open up the house for my kids, wipe the flies out of the windows, my favorite thing to do. On the way back to Boston, I stopped at a toll booth, pulled over, and called Teresa. She was crying hysterically. Baby, tell me. I said, why are you crying? Well, I'll tell you why, she said. Tim called and told me you were fucking other girls and you're still on drugs, and that's why you went up to New Hampshire alone. That's how good he was. Those devious little details. She just freaked. He had her on the phone for 20 minutes, screaming at Teresa. I had been married to her for 18 years by then. When I hung up the phone with Teresa, I called Bobby Hearn, my sponsor in AA. I said, Bobby, you better meet me at my house in Marshfield and get rid of all the guns, or I'm gonna fucking get my gun and shoot Tim Collins. I am so fucking furious. I mean, I totally went off. I don't allow myself to get into that state anymore because there's no one in my life I let do that to me. Now, I had to deal with my wife. It took me 2 weeks every day to get rid of the anger. Tim called the band into the office after I said it was over. Joe and I had been writing songs without them, so the guys in the band were already angry at me, and this gave Tim the power to get the rest of the band on his side. The next day, I walked into our rehearsal space and said to my partner, Joe, you fuck, why didn't you ask me if I was high, like we used to talk in the early days? Ugh, see how angry I get now just thinking about it. Wait, it gets better. When I saw the guys in the band again, I asked them, what were you guys thinking when you let Tim call my wife? All this stuff he told you was all just fucking hearsay from some friend of Tim's. And it was all particularly galling because it was one of the few times in my life that I was not drinking, was drug-free, and sexually abstinent. When I asked the band why they believed I was fucking everything that moved, they said, oh, Steven, what do we know? Tim convinced us. Fuck you. What if I call up your wife and said he's fucking this chick in his tiki hut? Tim Collins would get people going with his insinuating little sayings like, there's trouble in paradise. That's the fucking letter he wrote to my wife. Trouble in paradise. Tim Collins was famous for starting rumors, stuff that he made up himself. He was the fireman who sets the fires. He would go to Joe Perry's house, light a fire at night when no one was looking, go back to the firehouse, wait for the alarm, rush over there really quick, quicker than any other fireman, and put the fire out so he could be a hero. He did that time and time again. And then when the fire was out, he'd say, I saved your life. The very next day, he went up to Sony with Bob Timmons to see the president. So, Tim, Donnie Einer asks, you're telling me Steven's back on heroin? No hesitation. Yep, but don't worry, sir. I'm going to get him back into rehab. And in a month or two, he'll be all right again. I'll get him in the studio, do an album, and everything will be fine. God damn him, I tried. Oh, and it doesn't stop there. Then he went to Time Magazine and People and Rolling Stone. Aerosmith lead singer back on heroin. Shortly after this, I'm out to dinner with Einer at an Italian restaurant eating capezzelli di agnelli. Capezzelli, that's a dish of lamb's head. They bring the whole head out after it's been in the oven. I'm sitting at the table and I said, did Tim and fucking Bob Timmons come down here and tell you I was on heroin? And he got quiet and he goes, that's exactly what they said. And you believed him? Well, now, Steven, I don't want to cause any trouble here. I said, don't worry about that. We just fired him. Well, to be honest with you, I was thinking this was a little fucked. Oh, really? A minute ago, you wouldn't say anything because you didn't want to start any trouble. Well, Stevie, you see, I'm one of those people that, oh, fuck you and the horse you rode in on. While all this was going on, my daughter Mia called me up crying. She goes, Daddy, I'm so scared. Are you on drugs again? I was stunned to hear her so upset. Mia never cries. I took her out and told her, Mia, I'm not on drugs and I'm not hiding. I haven't gotten high in 9 years. We hugged, and she's crying in my arms. We turn the corner, and I open my eyes for a second, and there's that motherfucking paparazzi with a lens from here to Connecticut. I thought, God, does it never stop? Mia, here's what we're going to do. Hold on a minute. I went into a hardware store we happened to be walking past and asked, do you have an umbrella and a can of spray paint, in white preferably? I took the can, shook it up, and wrote, fuck you, on the umbrella, opened it up, put it behind us, and we walked down the street. Let him get a shot of that, all day. I did see it in a few stupid rags, but that was all right. Tim Collins put a spell on me. Svengali, that's who Tim Collins was. He would deliberately say whatever was on his agenda in front of groups of people to intimidate them. That way nobody would dare contradict him. It's like if you had been sitting around with a friend of yours the night before, and the next morning you're reading the newspaper and you go, oh my God, a woman's decapitated body was found in the woods. And just then your best friend walks in with a shrunken head. Now you're going to be real fucking careful what you say about that best friend of yours, not to mention he ain't your best friend no more. As I walked out of Tim Collins' office for the last time, I could see and feel the waves receding like the backwash of a speedboat on a calm lake. I turned around and said, this is the last fucking time I'm coming here or I'm ever going to utter your name. I fell into the wormhole of consuming anger. I could feel the weight of hatred welling behind me. It was like standing at the back of the Queen Mary and watching the waves that it throws off. I didn't talk to him again until 3 years ago in the elevator at the Mile High Stadium in Denver. "Mr. Tyler," he said, "so good to see you. There's something I've been wanting to say to you for a long time." "I know what it is. You want to ask my forgiveness for that remark." "How did you know?" "Oh, I knew. When I had last confronted him with all the outrageous things he's done, he simply said, 'I'm sorry, you must have mistaken me for someone who gives a shit.' I had been devastated. I loved him. I trusted him, believed in him, and he let me down. Abandonment and betrayal by managers has been an ongoing thorn in my side my whole career, but why should I be any different from any other performer?" Chapter 13.5, The Bitch Goddess of Billboard. Liv called me and said she got offered a part in a movie with Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck, and she wasn't sure if she wanted to take it because it was too commercial. "In what way?" I said. Her taste in movie roles was more offbeat and indie, like Stealing Beauty and That Thing You Do, which she had already done. So she says, "In the opening scene, Bruce Willis is teeing off an oil rig and trying to hit the Greenpeace boats. And then they go up in space to shoot down an asteroid." I said, "Are you kidding me?" She said, "I think it's too mainstream and commercial, Daddy." "Take it," I said. "There's nothing wrong with being a household name, baby." Meanwhile, Nine Lives came out in 97. That was such a fucking great album. I remember walking around with a finished cassette in my back pocket. Felt like a bar of gold. But look at the goop around it. We all got sober. Looking back, I think if we'd have stayed stoned, the band would never have come back and gotten its grip again. I was sober for 12 years. Joe had 4, Brad maybe had 8. If he was drinking wine, doesn't matter. Tom, who knows what he was doing. Joey's the only one that stayed sober through the whole thing. He's the only guy in the band who stayed the course. Some of the lyrics I wrote on the Nine Lives album was my rant, my rage. Maybe Tim Collins, Bob Timmons, and all the other sons of bitches stuck in my craw had to come out. "How can a good thing, 7 come 11, slip into a fare thee well? And how can one man's little bit of heaven turn into another man's hell?" But in the end, I came through all the turmoil philosophical and with eyes wide open. In the old game of life, best play it smart, with love in your eyes and a song in your heart. And if you've had problems since way back when, did the noise in your head bother you then? You know, I hope you see it as clear as I do. If you've been a problem since way back when, did the noise in your head bother you then? Forget fuck me, fuck them, fuck you. Does the noise in my head bother you? Are you fucked no matter what you do? No. If your life's been a lie, then ask him true. Does the noise in my head bother you? That one I wrote at my kitchen table up in Sunapee. I love tongue twisters, word games, and shit like that. My divorce from Teresa years later, in 2006. Wait, it's coming. Put the song Hole in My Soul into my heart's perspective. I'm down a one-way street, with a one-night stand, with a one-track mind out in no man's land. The punishments sometimes don't seem to fit the crime. Yeah, there's a hole in my soul, but one thing I've learned, for every love letter written, there's another one burned. So tell me how it's gonna be this time. Is it over? Is it over? Is it over? 'Cause I'm blowing out the flame. That kind of defines getting laid out on the road. I finally put into words how fooling around on someone you love back home could kick back on you. The one thing I've learned from being a singer and a poet is that it's often not what's been said, but how you lived it. I wrote Hole in My Soul with Desmond Child. It's one of my favorite songs. I came to him with the chorus, then went to the band and said, "Tom, what if you played this on a fretless bass?" I asked him to please, please get one. There's a hole in my soul that's been killing me forever. What a chorus that is. With every album we did, I tried to dig out the parts with the other members of the band to perfection. Listen to Tom's bass and Joey's snare and foot from Pump on Up. I pushed the rhythm sections up louder than they'd ever been. I worked on parts for Tom that I knew would pop out, and when it came time to mix, I pushed those parts out and added 3K to them, so they stuck out like the hard nipples that were about to listen to it. While we were tracking Nine Lives, the end of Hole in My Soul was playing. Chelsea and Taj walked into the studio with Teresa. I looked over and I said to them, "Good night, Chelsea. Good night, Taj." It's whispered at the end of the track. 10 years prior to making Nine Lives, I've been listening to the sound intro on the THX commercial that always plays. The audience is listening. Joe had bought this fucking guitar that would tune itself. It was a computerized Les Paul or something. So I took the guitar and I untuned it all over the fucking planet. I said, "Put that over on the left side of the studio." And he hit the button, and it went, wah, trying to retune itself, and wound up back in the key Taste of India started in. Then I said, "Can you control the time it takes to get to the chord? Slow it down?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah." So we slowed it down to this intro, 10 seconds, and I took that guitar, detuned the whole thing again, and put it over on the right side. Then we did it again and panned it over to the right side. And when we played them all together, we got this incredible sound that was the equivalent of shh, the audience is listening, but even better than the commercial THX. Then we added this loop that producer Glenn Ballard had lying around from Alanis's Jagged Little Pill, and I went, "Can I use that?" And he said, "It's yours, if you pay for it." We added a track of this Indian singer, and that's the music behind the opening verse of Taste of India. I went to an antique store and I found this little red church about a foot high and half a foot wide. It had a crank on the side of it and I went, "What's this?" The shopkeeper said, "Crank it." It had 3 harmonicas and a bellows. We used it at the end of Full Circle. On the next track, Something's Gotta Give, I took 2 trash cans, drumsticks, turned the cans upside down and played them. First song Joe and I ever wrote with Marty Fredrickson. Next track, a ballad, Ain't That a Bitch. The Farm is Marco Hudson. He wrote most of that. One of his finest fucking moments. He arranged the orchestra too. I wrote Pink with Richie Supa at the Marlin Hotel down in South Beach, Florida. I'd be writing and go, fuck. I'd turn the lights on when the sun went down. I'd turn the lights off when the sun came blasting through that big bay window. I loved writing lyrics at night. It was more mysterious than in the day. And I could evoke my demons when no one was around to bother me. The only problem was when normal people got up, like our producer Glenn Ballard, who was also a co-writer on Pink, they would expect me to go in and do my vocals later that morning, when what I really needed was some shut-eye. So most days at the old Marlin, we started recording at about 1 p.m., which left me 5 more hours of daylight before I sat down at the table again to turn the light on. This went on for 5 months until I started growing neon hair. Pink, it was love at first sight. Pink, when I turn out the light. And pink gets me high as a kite. And I think everything is gonna be all right, no matter what we do tonight. Pink, you could be my flamingo. Pink is the new Connie lingo. Pink, like a deco umbrella. It's kink, but you don't ever tell her. I threw in that line, "It's kink," because Richie Supa thought I should call the song kink. I said, "Richie, I can't sing kink in a song. My life is kink. I am kink." When I got hungry and thirsty for some South Beach sustenance, I would go down and have a carrot, an apple, a beet, a stick of celery, and a plug of ginger juice. And as I was told by the young Dave Dalton, who used to be English, that's what they would stick in a horse's ass to get their tails in the air and to prance and dressage. So when I drank this concoction that I got from the juice man, it made my ears stick out. What in the what the? Anyway, more often than not, I would write and sing a scat where there weren't lyrics yet. Thank you for the inspiration, Louis Armstrong, and fill up what the scat sounded like with lyrics. Didn't often make sense, but who gives a fuck, because it's only rock and roll. I scatted over the chorus line one day and I went, "Oh, fuck. Hello. I'm home. I want to be your lover. I want to wrap you in rubber. As pink as the sheets that we lay on, 'cause pink is my favorite crayon. Yeah. Pink It was love at first sight. Pink, when I turn out the light. Pink, it's like red, but not quite. And I think everything is gonna be all right, no matter what we do tonight. Ah, veni, vidi, vici. We came, we saw, we needed a Kleenex. Get the fuck out of Dodge. Songs are stories. Didn't all troubadour stories turn into songs? And didn't all the tales lead to the same thing? Saving the queen? Getting the girl? Wrapping her in rubber? Glenn Ballard started as producer on Nine Lives, but Joe Perry eventually threw him out because Glenn was working on tracking and vocals and wasn't paying attention to Joe's leads or working with him on guitar sounds. I said, why don't you talk to Glenn? You know it's your guitar, get your own sound. So along comes Kevin Shirley, who won Joe's heart by turning his amp up to 11 and who swore he'd rock the album like it hadn't been rocked before and needed to from the beginning. Kevin loved his rock and roll so much, and his style was so sawtoothed that he was dubbed the Caveman. Just what Aerosmith needed. The version of Pink, bits and pieces of vocals and miscellaneous trackage, was still there from the Florida sessions with Glenn Ballard. I had to scrap all the vocals and start over, which didn't come easy for me. Joe and Tim had talked Sony into thinking the album was jinxed by Glenn Ballard, since Tom, Brad, and Joey hadn't come to Florida yet. We were neck deep in the writing process when Glenn hired Steve Farrone to do the drum tracks. So we planned to layer in the guitars once they came down, unlike any other album we'd done yet. But no, I'd already sung all the vocals and harmonies to the album, and I was being told we were going to have to re-record the whole fucking thing, and Joey's having a nervous breakdown? Joe couldn't get his guitar sounds, and since Brad and Tom weren't on it yet, what the fuck, let's just scrap it and re-record everything. All the songs on Nine Lives would have been great, except Ballard's guys, who were in the studio during the early recording sessions and looked like zombies because they'd been up all night fixing Joe's timing on the tracks. Glenn had a reason to his rhyme and wanted the stuff put to grid, and the last thing Joe wanted was to be told what to do. Another reason why he had him ousted. The funny thing is, Jack Douglas had been adjusting Joe's guitar timing all the way back to the 70s. It's what producers did and still do. I walk around like a woman during pregnancy when I'm working on an album. I don't listen to anyone else's music. I just want to marinate in my own creativity. A song is constructed like a tree, from roots to branches, and when it's done, you hope it bears fruit. You need a first verse, next a second verse, then a pre-chorus, which is the titillating foreplay, then the cum shot, the payoff, being your chorus line. Then comes the bridge, which should bring you back to the chorus line. Then booyah, score, it's out of the park. So satisfying, because that chorus, when it works, epiphanates everything you ever thought of in your life, or whatever that song made you think about. It's got to pay off so deliciously that you just can't wipe it off. A little something that gets inside of you and changes your everything. That's always been my aim. And by the way, there are 9 others on that album that are also out of the park. No one can catch you. They're on the hood of a car on 49th Street from Yankee Stadium. It went where? While writing 9 Lives at the Marlin Hotel, Bono and Larry from U2 came to visit. We played the tracks for them, and they were blown away. Nice to have a solid wall to bounce your ball off. During the sessions, one of the finer producers on the planet, Tom Lord Alge, was in the studio in the basement of the Marlin Hotel diddling around with a song called If It Makes You Happy, which it did, extremely, after hearing it. That night, Joe and I went upstairs and wrote Kiss Your Past Goodbye, which was a premonition of the coming breakup between Collins and me. When I listen to it now, it's very eerie. It's later than a deuce of ticks. Your broken heart, it needs a fix. You're feeding off a high that would not last, and people, they don't seem to care. And sorry, just don't cut it, yeah. It seems to me you're getting nowhere fast. So kiss your past, or kiss your ass goodbye. I can pull a rabbit out of a hat by pulling a song out of a scat. I hear lyrics in my sleep, little embryonic words poking up out of the scat plasma. This is a pretty different approach to the way a professional songwriter like Diane Warren works. Diane sits down at the piano and out come the words and melody together, fully formed, the way you might build a chair. I'd hear one of her songs and think, How many affairs does this woman have to know how to put it so brilliantly? Oddly enough, she's married to a parrot named Buttwing, who keeps repeating, "That's brilliant, and I love it." Whereas my songs come out of the muck and mire of the muddy stream of consciousness, or, as I like to say, the stream of unconsciousness. I think my way of writing songs comes from when I first heard hymns and organ music in church, when God was still there under the pulpit in a box covered with red velvet. I grew up Presbyterian. I've walked with God all my life. You know, I always said my prayers. The music was so profound and stimulating, a cosmic harmony pouring into the soul of the congregation. That's why the organ is so powerful. People hear God in a song because music infuses your mind with melody. It floods your brain like the fluid in the placenta. So, in church, hearing those giant organs sweetly playing swelling chords and melodic soaring hymns, I just fell into that angelic sound. And at home, from age 1 or 2, I was lullabied to sleep with the notes of Debussy and Schubert. Looking for God? I did not come here looking for God. I brought him with me. Diane wrote, "I Don't Want to Miss a Thing." And that song, by the way, has one of the most brilliant front lines ever. If you're in love and your significant other ever says to you, "I could stay awake just to hear you breathing," you're going to drop and give her 20 right there on the floor, or nestle your head on her neck and believe that you wouldn't be able to live the rest of your life without her. We've all been there, haven't we? Songs are nothing but air and pure emotion, but they have intense effects on people's lives. When people relate passionately to a song, all that goes on in their lives gets attached to the song, and the music never stops. All they want to do is tell me how that was their wedding song or what they played at their wedding. How about the two guys who created the BlackBerry? They came up with the idea while smoking pot and listening to Sweet Emotion. At the Kennedy Honors, a prominent Democratic politician told me she had made love for the first time listening to Sweet Emotion. Half the current government of the United States has made love to Joe Perry's licks. John Kalodner introduced me to Diane Warren. It was an A&R man's equation. Big band, big money, big really talented songwriter. Big band needs big hit. I'd written a bunch of things with her before I Don't Want to Miss a Thing. When I was working on Devil's Got a New Disguise, I went out to her house in Malibu. She has a piano that looks out over the ocean, and I said, "So, we're going to write a song. How do we start?" "Well, I'll play you something." She played me a couple of things, mostly ballady, and it wasn't working. That's when I sat down and carved out that beginning piano live, and voila! Devil's Got a New Disguise started to take shape. Some years later, the song was completed. Sweet Susie Q, she was a revel. No angel wings, more like the devil. She was so hot, so cool and nasty. Believe it or not, here's what she asked me. "If you need love with no condition, let's do the do, honey, I'm on a mission. The girl's so bitchin', my backbone's twitchin', 'cause down in hell's kitchen, the devil's got a new disguise. I'm on a mission, a proposition. It's intuition, 'cause the devil's got a new disguise." And so that was Devil's Got a New Disguise. Another song Diane wrote that we recorded was Painted on My Heart. "And I've still got your face, painted on my heart, scrawled upon my soul, etched upon my memory, baby." Painted on My Heart was going to be taken by Johnny Hallyday, the French rock star. I gave him the stem mixes, I gave him my vocal, but at the last minute he didn't do it. A stem mix is the basic track. You put your vocal on it so the band can play behind it. It's a little like Guitar Hero, where you have the backing tracks and you leave space for the kid to play Joe Perry. Sometime in 1997, I got a call from Jerry Bruckheimer saying he'd like to put 4 or 5 Aerosmith songs in an upcoming movie. We were all for it, and that's when John Kalodner played me the song that Diane Warren wrote called I Don't Want to Miss a Thing. Little did I know that Kathy Nelson, who was picking the music, would put it in the same Jerry Bruckheimer movie, Armageddon, that Liv was talking about. Okay, let's get into the what-it-is-ness of Diane Warren. Diane had written the song already and got a Celine Dion sing-alike to make a demo. Diane put it on a cassette with her band doing it on synthesizers, all done in her studio. I listened to it in the car with John Collader and said, it's fucking great, but where's the chorus? It's a hit single without a doubt, but there's no chorus. A couple days went by, and Diane comes to the Sunset Marquee to my room where there was a grand piano. She sits down and starts playing I Don't Want to Miss a Thing. And because of the way she was singing it, I finally heard the chorus, and I went, oh my God. And I started to tear up. It was just that tonal difference between the Celine Dion wannabe version and the way she sold it and the way Diane sang it. Forget about it. It was a perfect example of it's the singer, not the song. The way she sang, I Don't Want to Close My Eyes, made a believer out of me, and the rest is history. In Diane's office, a room that she's used for the last 23 years, there's the same piano, cassettes from 30 years ago, and 30 number one singles on the wall. She walks around with that little green African parrot on her arm, butt wing, and never leaves home without it. That little fucker would live 100 years and it'll be singing, I Don't Want to Miss a Thing on the space shuttle to Mars. Damn, if Buttwing doesn't get there before me. Hey, Diane, everyone's fucking to your songs, I said. Do you ever get laid? She laughed shyly. I get it, I said. You take all the angst from not getting it and put it in a song. She goes, you got it. I'm just a frustrated romantic. Okay, I was hitting them out of the ballpark, but unbeknownst to me, I was cursed. Cursed as Cain, doomed as Captain Ahab. The 7 plagues of Egypt all fell on me. What did I do to bring this on myself? Did I desecrate the Pharaoh's tomb? Did I violate some dire taboo? Is there someone somewhere putting pins in a voodoo doll? Or was it the Faustian bargain I made with the bitch goddess of Billboard when she whispered in my ear, Steven, baby, how would you like a hit record? That'd be sweet. How about a number one hit record? Fuck yeah, honey, I'd do anything to get a number one record. Anything? Are you sure, Steven? Because you know there may be a price to pay. Hell, bring it on, said I recklessly. Whatever it is, I can handle it. Oh, yeah? Did I really say that? I should have gone to see the gypsy because before too long, I found myself in a world of trouble and pain. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Give me an E. Heavy is the head that wears the motherfucking Mad Hatter's hat. Thank you, God. May I have another. We would soon get our hit with I Don't Want to Miss a Thing. Came out in August 1998, stayed number one on Billboard's Hot 100 for 4 weeks. But before that happened, the price to pay, prophesied by the bitch goddess of Billboard, came horribly true. My litany of maladies, misfortunes, and woes began in the year of the rat. It started out uneventfully enough. The band had a day off. We were in the Allegheny Mountains. I called Joe's room and told him I wanted to lease a llama and fill our backpacks with crunchy peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and climb to the top of Pike's Peak. We hiked 5 miles up. Unbeknownst to Joe, I had a copy of I Don't Want to Miss a Thing, the version with the strings on it. So I brought my CD player and 2 sets of batteries, because I'm on to Murphy. We were on the edge of a cliff, Joe sitting on the top of the mountain eating a sandwich, and I walk off about 100 feet away. I looked over, found a little place to sit down, and listened to I Don't Want to Miss a Thing under the headphones, with that orchestra welling up and me watching eagles soar for the first time in my life, and I wept like a baby. And then I knew that we really had something. Just like the time I listened to Love in an Elevator, going, whoops, this is gonna be a hit. I knew. The crying part of I Don't Want to Miss a Thing. Dun, 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 dun. It was like, fuck, wait till they hear this. Never mind, is it gonna be? I don't want to jinx anything, but guess what? I know what's on the radio. This is better. The first demon of excruciating pain visited me a week later. We were on tour in Alaska playing the Sullivan Arena in Anchorage on April 29th, 1998. We'd never done Alaska, so I said to management, if that's the only state in America that we haven't played, we've got to do it. So we're up there in Anchorage, and we're doing Train Kept A-Rollin'. At the end of the song, during Joey's drum bit, I do this thing where I jump in the air, do a spread eagle split, and at the same time swing my scarf-festooned mic stand around. The bottom of the mic stand weighs around 4 pounds, and as I go up in the air, I accidentally whack the inside of my left knee with it. It's like hitting your funny bone with a 4-pound hammer. Your knee will go all tingly with electricity, so for a moment, you can't feel your leg. And that's what happened to me. I landed, but because my knee was tingling and numb, I didn't have any sensation in that leg when I hit the stage, and the ACL in my left knee shredded, ripped right out. Your ACL is a ligament inside the knee, anterior cruciate ligament. It's what holds your knee on. And this happened not in mid-concert or mid-song, but right at the end of the show. Train Kept the Rollin', our encore song. In other words, I fell down at the conclusion of our show, providing an unintended climax. I'm lying there, writhing in pain, going, ah! No one realizes what's just happened to me. I played it like it was part of the show. And I looked back at my tour manager and I mouthed the word, ambulance. He went, what? He didn't understand yet. But I knew that I'd hurt myself beyond any pain I'd ever felt before. I could tell something really bad had happened. The ambulance came. They gave me a shot of what I love. I didn't know what it was, but I could hear the opening line of Strawberry Fields floating through my head. At the hospital, they said, here's what you did. You tore your ACL. It's going to take 2 weeks for the swelling to go down before we can go in arthroscopically to look around and see what the damage is and take care of it. 2 weeks. And here's what you've got to do. Ice it every day and get that swelling down. Fuck. End of the tour. Wrong time to make the donuts. And right into the video of I Don't Want to Miss a Thing. After that, we went somewhere in the Midwest to do the video for I Don't Want to Miss a Thing. I'm still in a cast, packed in ice, and if you watch that video, you'll see that they only shoot me from the waist up. Just like Elvis. The director created a futuristic scenario using 200 cones. Geodesic shapes and stuff. The stylist had Betsy Johnson make me a very freaky coat, as I found out later, out of human hair. I instinctively knew what to do with it, so I fucked with it, using it as a prop, just like I did with the mask at the beginning of Crying. Right after that video, we had a number one single. What are the fucking chances? Well, I kind of sort of knew we would. Later that fall, I ran into the bitch goddess of Billboard at a convention in the Bahamas. What are you looking so glum for, baby? She asked with her crooked smile. Didn't you get your number one with a bullet? Are you kidding? That stuff with the ACL, that wasn't funny, I said. Ah, well, honey, we all gotta pay our dues, said she. And by the way, baby, there just might be a little more of that to come. Before I got a chance to ask her what she meant, she vanished. Got home, had to ice my knee another week before I went in for the operation. And when I came out of that wormhole, it was pretty fucking paralyzing, even though they did it arthroscopically. That means they drill a little hole in your knee and go in with a scope so they can see inside. They fill the inside of your knee with water, then flush it out so they can observe what's going on in there with a miniature camera. On the camera are little scissors, and they cut the ends of the ACL off. It looks just like spaghetti. They take out your torn ACL and put in someone else's. It's called an allograft. When they take the ligament out of your other leg, that's called an autograft. I said, fuck that. Pass the cadaver, doc. I'm a creature who lives on stage. I need both legs, and I need all the help I can get. He said, well, we got a freezer in the other room full of knuckles from people who died, and we can use ligament from one of those, because knuckles are like ACLs. They take little blood supply, and you don't have to worry about rejection. So they cut a ligament from this 16-year-old kid's knuckle, and use that to replace the ACL in my knee. Every night when I say my prayers, I say them twice, and I thank that kid who gave me the ligament for my knee. Got home the first day after they screwed my new ACL in and iced it. Second day, I get into this machine. You Velcro your foot into it. It has a slow-moving motor that moves your foot straight out, and then it goes up to a bend while the ice bag is on. It goes, moving your leg up slowly and then back down. That's the first 2 weeks. Did that hurt? Oh, fuck yeah. I was on painkillers, but still, it's what you have to do to get out. The only way out is through. It took 4 months, but after that I was in pretty good shape. It still hurt, but my knee was well enough for me to go on the next Aerosmith tour. We had to go right out because by that time, I Don't Want to Miss a Thing was number one, and all these opportunities came up. We played Madison Square Garden again. I brought a girl out on tour with me. She massaged me 3 times a day, iced it, massaged it, iced it. When they massage a scar, it goes away. That's why I don't have any scars. I wore a leg brace on stage for 6 months after that. When I first got it, it was mummy white. I said, paint it black. I cut all my pants off at the knee, and it looked pretty cool. Steven, the bionic man. We had to tour, so that was